You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody. This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. I'm going to be joined by all the beat writers from the AL Central and talking about a division that's really shaping up to be an interesting division race down the stretch. We spoke last week about it potentially being a three-team race with the Indians joining in the fray with the Tigers and Royals. And depending on the day, some days it looks like a two-team race, sometimes it looks like a three-team race. What we know for sure is that the Tigers are definitely being tested for the first time in a while in that division, and it's certainly been interesting to watch the Royals really push them here down the stretch. So we'll see how all that shakes out, and we'll talk about it. Thanks for tuning in. Joined by Dick Cagle, talk about a Royals team that remains neck and neck with the Tigers as we head down into the final weeks of the season. It's going to be a really exciting time in the American League Central. That's a legit two-horse race, maybe even three-horse if the Indians can shake off some of their recent struggles against Detroit. But the Royals have obviously put themselves in a good position, and now it's going to be interesting to see how they rise to the occasion as far as a lot of those young guys playing in their first legit pennant race. So let's bring in Dick to talk about that. DK, first of all, we saw last weekend the series against the Indians that I guess we can almost call it a sweep. They still remains to be seen Kansas City's last at bat that they'll have in Cleveland on September 22nd to continue the suspended game. But it certainly was a rough weekend for them in front of some really big crowds, and invited the question from a lot of people: Is this team ready to handle that kind of pressure and the big crowds and the expectations and the pulse of the pennant race? What's your read on that?
Yeah, I don't think these largely young players, certainly salted with a lot of veterans. I don't think they're overawed by these big crowds. I think it's just kind of a coincidence that they happen to lose when they get 30,000 plus out there. I don't think they're awed by it. I think this is a pretty level-headed team. I don't think that they're shaken by being in a pennant race or anything like that. I think it's just happenstance that, oddly enough, they get a big crowd and they don't play that well. The problem, really, Anthony, has been the recent lack of offense, which was their problem earlier on in the season.
Right.
Then they hit that hot stretch and they were hitting well and everything was going great. And now they've just kind of hit one of those lulls. How baseball is. It goes in cycles, and I think they just hit one of those lulls where the offense just isn't quite up to snuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a problem for a long stretch of the season. You don't expect that problem to completely go away. As hot as they were in August, they're definitely going to be tested here down the stretch, especially at a point where every out, every pitch matters so much. There's an extra intensity to that, and the good news there is their offense is a lot more whole now with Eric Hosmer coming back. Boy, a lot happened between July 31st when they found out for sure they're going to be without him for a few weeks, and September 2nd when he came back. Billy Butler took off, and Josh Willingham was added. So I guess the question with Hosmer is, how this is all going to work out, who's going to play where and when, because Nori Aoki has also played better, in that stretch. So, as far as right field goes, getting Willingham there is maybe a challenge, or utilizing the DH spot with Butler and Willingham and Hosmer. Any good gut feeling on how it all shakes out?
Well, my gut feeling is you're going to see a lot of Eric Hosmer at first base. That's for sure. I think the imponderable really is how often Butler will be in there at DH. I think Billy's going to see quite a bit of action. Billy was hitting very well that month that Hosmer was gone. And I think Ned Yost is going to, as he always says, do matchups. And against certain right-handers, I think he'll play Raul Ibanez with his left-handed bat in there in the DH spot. I think most of the time, really, you're going to see Billy Butler in there at the DH, because Billy really turned it on in that month that Hosmer was gone. And I think Billy, he can smell playoffs too. He's a very dedicated teammate, player, hitter. I think Billy's going to be all right this last month. The good news is Hosmer's back, but the good news is also that the pitching has continued to be really good, and the three guys at the back end of the bullpen have just been dynamite. Unbelievable.
Yeah, they've been, those three guys alone have made them one of the better bullpens in baseball, in my opinion. And Yost has, even taken to using them in some tie situations, instead of just preserving leads, but also just maintaining ties to give them a chance late. So that's led to some concern, I'm sure, about, overwork, but those guys seem to, they've held up very well.
Yeah.
I guess the, one nice thing is they call up the kid Brandon Finnegan. They just took 17th overall in the draft, and you don't expect him to be thrown right into high leverage situations by any means, but he's another nice arm for them potentially here down the stretch. A nice left-handed arm, obviously put up good numbers at TCU and put up good numbers in the minor leagues, and they kind of. It's always interesting to see these teams in the playoff chase. It's kind of like all rules go out the window. You call that kid right up and get him in there because you need as many hot hands as possible.
Yeah, exactly. I just was talking to Ned Yost about that the other day, and I said, Ned, it's kind of unusual to bring up a kid like Finnegan, who was just drafted this year, a kid like Terrence Gore, who started out the year in Class A, as a pinch runner. But he said they're here because they're good at something.
Yeah.
And they could fit in a certain niche going down the stretch. Finnegan is a good left-handed pitcher. He may fit as a lefty specialist after he gets a couple of games under his belt going down the stretch. Terrence Gore, they say, is the fastest guy in baseball, faster than Jerrod Dyson or anybody else, as they say. And he can serve a very useful spot as a pinch runner, in the late innings for some of these middle-of-the batting order guys who don't run too well. So, everybody they brought in, they've got 36 guys on the roster now. Everybody they brought in can serve a certain spot.
That would be interesting to see line up Gore and Dyson and Billy Hamilton and maybe D. Gordon, get those guys lined up and have a little foot race. Huh? But actually, I like Gore wears number zero. I like that about him.
Yeah, well.
You don't see too many zeros.
That may represent his time from home plate to first base. I don't think.
Could be. DK, I also want to ask about Salvador Perez. A couple weeks back there was some worry about his knee, and they did the MRI, and thankfully that came back all right, and he hung in there. And just a difference this guy makes, not just offensively, obviously, but behind the plate. I saw Jim Leland called him the Pudge Rodriguez of today, which is obviously a very high compliment. The work he does with the pitchers and also throwing out opposing base runners. And Royals fans know this like the back of their hand by this point, but it's certainly nice when a team like this gets into a situation like this where their games attract so much more national interest to, more people get a chance to see this kid and just how special he is behind the plate.
Well, he is very special, obviously. Such a big guy, he's 6'3" and 250 yeah. pounds. But so agile behind the plate and so quick. It's just amazing. And his feet move quickly. His arm is a cannon. He gets off those snap throws for pickoffs, and just amazing. And beyond all that, he's very smart, and he calls a great game. The pitchers love to pitch to him. And, he smothers the balls, and it's just unbelievable. On top of everything else, he hits. He's got a good power, and just this week he's come through with some big clutch hits. So, and the kid is, he's he's happy, he's outgoing, he's smiling, he's got the belly laugh, the big voice, the booming voice. He's a team leader at a very young age. I think he's still 23. So, Salvador Perez is a very special kind of player.
Well, it's a special time of year. Are you seeing a lot of are you sensing or seeing a lot of scoreboard watching in general, and keeping their eyes on especially a week like this where the Tigers and Indians are playing each other? I'm sure there's kind of one eye on what they have to do, but also one eye on what's going on there as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they pay attention. I know Jeremy Guthrie, after he pitched the other night, and Detroit was playing in Cleveland. He was in the clubhouse after he got his seven innings finished and was watching the end of that game, you know, while I was keeping an eye and an ear on what was going on outside of Kauffman Stadium. So, yeah, these guys, they're very well aware of what Detroit and Cleveland are doing. That's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Well, definitely looks like it's come down to the wire. So we'll see how it shakes out for the Royals. And I want to thank Dick Cagle for joining us. Joined by Jason Beck, and talk about a Tigers team that, depending when you listen to this, it could be a game up, a game back, a half game up, a half game back. That's just kind of the daily swings and sways of a legit division race, and it's one the Tigers fans are frankly unaccustomed to, because usually the team is kind of one going away here down the stretch, but they're really being tested this year. They rose to the challenge the first 2 days in Cleveland with a big outburst on Labor Day against Corey Kluber, and then a big comeback win off the bat of J.D. Martinez. But I want to bring in Beck to talk about a little bit about Miggy Cabrera, who was so big in those two games, particularly shaking off a really rough August for him, batting .252 with a .691 OPS in August, and obviously playing through some discomfort, especially in the ankle, and that's something that could affect him the rest of the year. Beck, what's your read on that injury and how much? I mean, obviously you watch him moving around; he's just not moving around very well at all. They're definitely slotting him in at DH more. Is that something you expect to see for the remainder of the year, or is it a situation that could be addressed with a couple of days off? What's your read on it?
I think for the most part, I would expect to see him as a DH. Brad Ausmus wanted to kind of handle it day to day and check with him, and then the other day he didn't even bother checking with him and just put him in as a DH. So I think as long as he's hitting well and he's comfortable sitting between at bat, I think they'll do it that way. I know one thing that with some other injuries that Brad was worried about with some other guys, especially with Virgil Martinez, is that when you're the DH and you're sitting between at bats, if it's a few innings, sometimes whatever injury you have kind of stiffens up, and when you try to move it again, it's really sore, or maybe it gets worse, or something along those lines. And I think that was one of Brad's worries. And I think too, he wanted to do whatever maybe he felt comfortable doing. And I think now you're seeing Brad kind of taking the lead a little bit on this one, and kind of putting out a plan. And as long as Cabrera doesn't object, I think that's what they're going to proceed with.
Last year they're really hesitant to sit him despite a healthy division lead in September. This is a much different scenario. He's such a big bat for them at a big time. So, I'm sure they'd like to get him a little more rest. A few days off would probably help the ankle considerably if given proper treatment. But they're just really not in a position where they can do that.
No. And I remember one thing last year that really, and it was more Cabrera than anything. He was worried about sitting more than a couple of days up until the very end of the regular season, just because he didn't want to get his bat cold. And I think as long as he's hitting well, he's not going to want to come out of there. This is the best he's looked in weeks, if not months. So I think certainly Tigers fans are going to want to keep that going. But I think more than anything, he's going to want to keep that going. He doesn't want to risk losing that, just kind of knowing what his thinking was, in a similar situation last year, even though it was a different type of injury. Once he gets going like that, he worries about losing whatever got him going again.
Well, speaking of getting going again, I mean, that middle of the order is such a minefield with Miggy and Victor and J.D. Martinez. And we talked last week a little bit about J.D. and how he struggled out the gate in the second half. And you wonder, is he going to find that old form from the first half? But you talked about him kind of going with pitches a little more and, mixing in a few more singles and just being a more consistent hitter. But he obviously still has the power as well. That was such a huge home run for them. Tuesday night in Cleveland, and you just really have to stop to think, where would this team be without this pickup in late March? That was such a small, it's one of those things you write maybe 4 or 6 paragraphs, right, and move on, but, he's really become such a key piece for them.
Yeah, I remember near the end of spring training, it was basically just one of those extra notes at the bottom that, they right. picked up this guy. He's got some major league experience, and, they kind of looked at him as insurance, that, just having a nice, power bat if they needed it, well, after some early season struggles and, people forget, Tyler Collins, who's up as a September call-up now, he made the opening day roster because they felt like they wanted that left-handed bat, and he struggled horrendously in a reserve role. And then between that and the 10 home runs that J.D. Martinez hit in April, that got him the call up. If not for him, this offense looks drastically different, and really this whole team in general, because if you don't have J.D. Martinez, I don't think you can afford to trade Austin Jackson. I think you almost have to focus on, getting they would have had to focus on getting some sort of power bat, near the trade deadline, and those were hard to come by. It's funny to think what type of different direction this team could have been headed in.
And, you need those unexpected contributors as part of any playoff run, whether it's in a supporting role or in this case, a really primary role. But a guy who's really stepped up for the Tigers down the stretch here is Kyle Lobstein, at a time when the rotation was in some manner of disarray, really. And they ran through Robbie Ray and gave Buck Farmer a couple opportunities trying to maintain things in the rotation with the discomfort endured by Verlander and the loss of Anibal Sanchez. But Lobstein's been the guy who's really stepped up. We went 5 and a third, 2 runs allowed, five walks and 10 strikeouts against the Indians the other night. And, parlayed that with a nice start against the Yankees. It's starting to look like the Tigers have something here in the back end of the rotation.
Yeah, it's funny because usually with guys like that, they have a nice first outing, and then as teams get scouting reports going on them, they get exposed a little bit. And he's right. almost gotten better with each outing. And that outing in Cleveland was just such a different type of look because, he's not that high strikeout type of pitcher, and he's usually more of a command guy. So the walks and the strikeouts were kind of out of character for him. If you look at the AAA stats too, his stats in Toledo were fairly mundane. Not only was he not a high strikeout guy, he wasn't really a low ERA guy. But he comes up, and the thing he was able to consistently deliver in AAA was innings, and he's certainly doing that now. And, considering they had that stretch in Minnesota where they had back-to-back rookie starters getting yanked in the second inning, giving this team innings is huge. So, and if you can give them a chance to win, even better.
Beck, I know they're not totally ruling out Anibal Sanchez making a return, but in recent days there have been reports of him being pain-free, but still not throwing. I don't know if that kind of speaks for itself or what, but should we basically cross him off the list, or do you think there's still some chance of something happening there?
I hate to eliminate any chance because, it's hard to tell sometimes with guys like this, and especially, when you have, a team with World Series aspirations and, a guy who badly wants to win a World Series like this kid does, I don't want to completely write him off for the season, but it's just logistically, it's hard to see how he progresses to getting back to where he was or anywhere really near it. Maybe he makes a couple starts near the end, but I think if anything, this might well answer the question of how the Tigers sort out their, you know, postseason rotation if they're fortunate enough to get there. That it's hard to see Anibal Sanchez being able to, you know, even get up innings wise to a point where you can rely on them to pitch a game in a best of five or best of seven series.
Kind of similar with Joaquin Soria. He's making progress, but there's nowhere for him to pitch. But it's obviously a lot different for a reliever to build up a level of tolerance. But he's throwing off flat ground, so starting to get to a point where you can see him getting back in the mix. That obviously be huge for that bullpen because they're really running on fumes right now.
Yeah, I mean that's and especially when you consider the role that they would have for him coming back. You know, you don't need him to swallow two innings at a time or.
Yeah.
Even a full inning would be almost a luxury. You can get a batter or two out of him, you know, two out of every 3 days or three out of four. Now, sometimes that's the missing link for these guys, having that reliable guy you can bring in with runners on base and get a key out for you. Now, they're getting guys to fill some innings, you know, especially if you can get these relievers a clean inning to start out with. You know, I think that makes all the difference in the world with a kid like Albuquerque. But, you know, for Soria, if you can plug him in that type of role, that's huge, I think.
Well, they're still, you know, it's going to be an interesting race because the Royals have just never been in this position before. So you wonder about them kind of playing tight down the stretch. And the Tigers' bullpen is obviously a big thing to watch. But, you know, you can't put a price on – well, I guess you can put a price on veteran leadership because those guys make a lot of money. But they have those guys who have kind of been there, done that. So it'll be interesting to see you know, that dynamic. But I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us. Joined by Jordan Bastian. We're going to talk Tribe, talk about a team that made a late push in the American League Central, had a really tough go of it in the first two games of a big series against the Tigers, though. So it's kind of they're in that position where every loss feels a bit like a dagger. Every win feels a bit like you're right back in it. They don't have much room for error here down the stretch. And Jordan, a big part of that, obviously, is Corey Kluber. They really need this guy to be the guy he's been most of the season. His last few starts have been a little shaky by his standards. His start against the Tigers on Labor Day particularly was, well, there's a lot of labor involved in that day. So, you know, as he gets past that 200-inning mark, somewhere he's never been before, obviously, you know, there has to be some concern just about fatigue. I know he won't admit it, the team doesn't admit it, but I'm sure that's in the back of everybody's mind.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's interesting is, you know, when you talk to Kluber, he does, first thing he says is he's fine. He doesn't feel fatigue. But in speaking with pitching coach Mickey Callaway, he said, you know, that's to be expected that the pitcher is always going to say that he feels fine. And he probably does feel fine. But, you know, when you are approaching that 200 inning threshold for the first time, you know, a guy that pitched around 150, 160 innings last year between the minors and the majors missed time because of a hand injury. So this year he's really getting into that full deep season, you know, and could be coming up to 220, 230, you know, that really impressive workhorse range. You know, for the first time, yeah, he's going to be dealing with fatigue that he may not really realize, you know, where it could be affecting his mechanics, where he might feel physically fine, but maybe he's dragging a little bit and it's causing some, you know, chain reaction within his mechanics. And I think that's what pitching coach Mickey Callaway and Kluber kind of identified over this last week, that there have been some delivery flaws of late, and some of that could be related to fatigue, you know, whether or not the pitcher, you know, admittedly feels tired.
The interesting dynamic there is after Kluber, there's really no worry about fatigue because the Indians have had so much change within the rotation as the year's gone along, guys going up and down and in and out of the starting roles. And then they've been so proactive all year and aggressive with their use of the bullpen that, you know, the starters' innings have really been limited overall. So they got some fresh arms down the stretch, and one of the freshest belongs to Carlos Carrasco, who's just been incredible. In five starts since rejoining the rotation, an ERA under one. Opposing hitters are batting about .190 off of him. So it's starting to be pretty convincing that this guy has finally put together a starting role after a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, and I think what was most impressive was not only the fact that you know, he came out and had a, you know, good string of scoreless innings and all that. But, I mean, that was his first three, four outings were almost looked like, you know, he worked with apparent ease. You know, I think what was interesting in the start against the Tigers was he really worked. You know, he gave up 10 hits, struck out 10. I think 7 of his 10 strikeouts came when the Tigers had runners in scoring position. You know, and it just seemed like every inning he gave up, you know, 2 hits, had guys on, was in trouble, and then just really, you know, anchored down and got through the inning unscathed. I think that was what was most impressive since his return to the rotation, was the first time he really was struck with adversity, he still was able to reel things in, settle down, and you saw him show some emotion out on the mound too, which is not something we've been accustomed to with Carrasco. You know, it looked like he struck a guy out and just gave a shout and kind of pumped his fist as he came off the mound. And, you know, it's good to see that down the stretch with the position that the Indians are in, you know, and kind of all of a sudden how important he is to that rotation. So yeah, that's been a blessing here down the stretch, one of the better stories within a pretty turbulent season for the Indians, and, you know, obviously one that bears watching down the stretch and then even as we start forecasting to 2015.
Yeah, he's always had great stuff. Obviously, the heat, and he's got that sort of backup slider, especially against right-handers, just a nasty pitch. You know, when that's going good, I remember talking to Chris Anthony going into the year and say, you know, there's as good a chance as anything that he's closing games for them at this point in the season. But here he is starting them. I'm just wondering, you're around him so much. What was his personality in that relief role? Do you think that's affected his personality now in a starting role? Does he approach pitching maybe from a different mentality or mindset than he did before that bullpen stint?
You know, it's funny because he was in the bullpen last year and he was so successful in that role last year.
Right.
And there was a lot of talk of he really stopped worrying so much about planning. You know, where when he was in the starting role before, he would spend so much time within the 5 days of studying the hitters and really kind of planning. And almost he made it sound like getting in his own head, and buried underneath the scouting reports and things like that. Almost like he had too much time on his hands. You know, and then when he moved to the bullpen, he kind of threw it out the window. When he knew he was only going for one inning or a few batters, he could really focus on just being really ultra aggressive, pounding the strike zone, pitching to his strengths, and worrying less about the hitter's strengths. And I think now when they found that time frame to transition him back to the rotation, after he did the bullpen role for a number of months, he really was able to get a firm grasp on not only that mentality, but also a routine, you know, and kind of pitching out of the stretch, which you're seeing him do in the rotation right now. You know, so he kind of finally figured out what they meant in terms of taking that aggressive mentality that he had in the bullpen and using it as a starting pitcher. And I think that's what you're finally seeing is him, that understanding of what they hoped he would do over the winter and carried into the starting role at the beginning of the season. Maybe it was better for him to do in the, you know, confines of a season without that long break where he went right from the bullpen, right to the rotation, and he was able to kind of really more fluidly have that transition and carry over with that mentality.
Well, here's the bad news. Carlos Carrasco's in trouble because we just talked about him on this podcast, and a week ago we were talking about Cody Allen on this podcast, and what a blessing he's been in the back of the bullpen and finally calming some frayed nerves for Indians fans who have seen so much uncertainty in that closing role over the years. And I mean, it's only natural closers are going to blow saves. It's just that Allen coughed up, you know, two of them in a really pivotal point of the calendar here, you know, coughed it up to Alex Gordon in Kansas City, and the Indians responded and rebounded from that and put themselves in a position to win that game when it gets resumed later this month. But, you know, the big one against the Tigers, against J.D. Martinez in what was a 2-1 game in the ninth inning. Is there concern over Allen at this point just from the workload? I know they've been, as we said earlier, they've been really aggressive with the bullpen use, but they've also been careful with the amount of innings. You know, it's a lot of appearances, but not necessarily as many innings as appearances for a guy like Allen. But still, he's definitely been used a lot. Is that something that's a concern here down the stretch?
Yeah, I think it's something that as more arms are available in September, you're going to see more guys take some of those innings that fell on some of the main guys down the stretch. You know, I think that's important for not only a guy like Allen, but because it kind of has that trickle effect. Guys like Atchison, Shaw, Zabchinski, those guys that if they're not being used in certain spots, maybe they can be backed up a little bit, and that can ease the workload off Allen. Because I do think not just this season but last season as well, you know, if you look at how much Allen has worked, I mean, he's been Francona's go-to guy. And the worry, I guess, in terms of recent history with the Indians would be, you know, the guy that comes to mind is Vinny Pistano, who, you know, soared through the minors, became a fixture in the bullpen, was thought to be the future closer, just got worked to death by Manny Acta, and then we saw what happened all of a sudden dealing with drop velocity and injuries and now dropped to the minors and now no longer even in the organization. So, you know, you hope, you know, that's obviously kind of the worst-case scenario of an overworked reliever, and I think the Indians are very cognizant of how much they use Allen and how much he has value to that bullpen, how important he is. So I think it's going to be something down the stretch here where, you know, I think Francona will definitely have that in mind, you know, as he works through the usage and tries to save bullets, especially if they want to continue to hang in this thing and, you know, have those guys available potentially, you know, for October if it gets that far.
One last thing, JB, you know, the offense has had its own inconsistencies, and some of that comes down to who they're playing lately, which is they're playing a lot of young kids and thrust into prominent roles with injuries or just overall changes. And but it does sound like David Murphy's making a lot of progress in his return from the oblique, and he was a really important bat for them, you know, earlier this season. Is that are things looking good for him to return in a reasonable amount of time here?
Yeah, he's going to be starting a minor league rehab assignment this week. You know, kind of worked out with AAA Columbus making the playoffs along with some of the other affiliates. So even though we're into September, you can still kind of navigate a minor league rehab scenario. So I think he's been coming along right on schedule, maybe even a little ahead of the schedule that we thought. You know, when you hear oblique, you know, especially at the time of year that it was, like there was some fear that it could threaten the season, but looks like he'll be back soon, and, you know, with the flexibility of September rosters, you know, even if it's a situation where he can't come back and be the everyday right fielder, you know, they could still activate him and have him available on a part-time basis, which was kind of the idea going into the year, too. You know, they really wanted him to come in and be a weapon against right-handed pitching, and, you know, down the stretch as they ease him in, I would imagine that could be the type of way they handle him, because they've got so many bodies in that clubhouse now and a lot of young guys, as you mentioned, up from the minor leagues. And I think, you know, the strength has been the pitching lately, both the rotation and the bullpen, and it's taken a lot of the onus off of the offense. I think if it were a different scenario, we might be sitting here talking about what's wrong with this offense and what they can do going forward to fix it. But the pitching's been so good that they've been hanging in, and three or four runs has been working. So, you know, it's not necessarily a formula that works over the long haul, but it's been working over the last few weeks.
Yeah, there's so many emotional swings and sways this time of year anyway. I mean, you win a couple, you're in it. You lose a couple, it looks like you're out of it. So the Indians are still in it on measure. You know, you think about Detroit's bullpen issues. You think about, you know, the possibility of Kansas City maybe playing a little tight. Guys who've never really been in the playoff chase before. So, but they definitely need to take advantage of the division games that are in front of them. So, I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us, joined by Scott Merkin, and going to talk about a White Sox team that's, you know, still evaluating players here down the stretch and putting themselves in a decent position to, you know, potentially contend next year in 2015. And, Merk, one guy we thought we might see down the stretch here, a guy who could be a really important piece for them next year, is Carlos Rodon, their number one draft pick from this past June. They decided, though, not to call him up and put him in the bullpen, rather keep him on a more traditional development path, I guess, which is, you know, it's obviously rare for a guy to be drafted and called up in the same year. They've done it before with Chris Sale, but as Rick Hahn pointed out, I mean, that was a different situation in 2010. That was a team that finished a game out of the wild card. This White Sox team is not in that same competitive state, so I guess you can understand a little more patience in this scenario, can't you?
Yeah, you know, I was a little surprised when I didn't see his name on the list, because it just seemed like with the path they had moved him on, you know, with the challenges they had put in front of him, starting at Arizona Rookie League and then going to Winston-Salem and then going to Charlotte, that, you know, the next logical step with the way he had pitched, and, you know, you had talked to people who saw him and said he was, you know, the best pitcher on the Charlotte team, even with just three starts down there. The next step was coming to the majors. But then you hear Rick talk, and you totally understand that, you know, there was a deliberation that went into the process, but that, as you pointed out, you know, there were a number of reasons, and you mentioned one of them, that, you know, they aren't in contention. Another thing is Chris Sale came in a little quicker to the fold than Rodon did, so, you know, that took a little bit of time off the development process there. And they just, right. You know, really the ultimate decision, the ultimate factor was what's best for him in terms of a starter. Now, Chris was a reliever for, you know, parts of two seasons, one full season,
right.
And the one, you know, short period when he was drafted. Rodon's going to be a starter. This is going to be, you know, 100%. And they didn't feel bringing him up in September, using him maybe as a reliever and then maybe a starter two down the stretch was the most conducive process to having him ready to, you know, have a shot at the rotation. Rick said out of spring training in 2015. Now, again, just like there was never, you know, a flat-out no that he's not coming up in September during this whole time, Rick didn't guarantee that it would be foolish to guarantee that he's going to break camp with the team considering he's, you know, been thrown 24 and two-thirds professional innings so far. But it does sound like he's got a real good chance to break with the team out of spring training next year, depending on what he does and, you know, the off-season program they've given him and then how he performs in spring training. So it does make sense. You know, I understand, as Rick said, fans wanted to see him up there. Rodon wanted to be up there. Obviously, as a competitor, you always want to keep moving. The White Sox, they wanted to see him up there, but in the end, everyone understood the decision, including Carlos, according to Rick.
Well, I mean, you can see both sides of it, getting that first exposure and those first nerves, I guess, out of the way. But at the end of the day, it would be two different scenarios anyway, coming up in September to pitch a couple, you know, dare I say, meaningless innings out of the bullpen versus, you know, next time he comes up or when he does come up next season in a starting role, really. So a difficult one, but I guess the White Sox kind of put themselves – the only reason this is a conversation is the White Sox have done in the past with Sale, but it's obviously a much different scenario.
I was going to say, it's also a conversation in the fact that, you know, he's really come that fast. You know, Rick made that point real clear that they had high hopes for. Remember, we're not talking about an 18-year-old raw kid out of high school. This is a kid who's pitched 3 years in a big-time conference in a big-time program. So he was advanced coming up already. And there were a lot of people who thought he was, you know, going to be the number one pick in the draft, and he was the most major league ready of all the pitchers. So they had high expectations, and Rick said he's already exceeded those expectations. But in the absolute long run, it wasn't worth it to his process to bring him up for, like you said, a couple relief appearances, maybe a spot start you could play up and, you know, some Monday on a homestand or maybe the final four games that, you know, is going to be celebrating Paul Konerko as well and say, hey, on Friday, come see our future. Carlos Rodon is getting a start. It just didn't make sense in the long run.
Yeah. And those numbers he's put up, definitely something for White Sox fans to dream on over the winter. One guy they did call up, and it was surprising, Michael Taylor, a guy who's a former top prospect. He was in that Roy Halladay trade between the Phillies and Blue Jays, and then was flipped for Brett Wallace. And Taylor and Wallace really became footnotes in the long run. But Taylor's kind of rebuilt his value a little bit since coming over to White Sox this summer. Hit .306 with six home runs and 38 RBIs at Charlotte. So I guess they'll give him a look here, Merck, and see what they've got. I know. You know, there's some sense of urgency there just with him as far as contractual control goes and seeing what they got, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, I think the other person who there was a surprise that wasn't included was Jared Mitchell, who was the team's 2009 top draft pick, had a bad season-ending – I guess there's never a good season-ending injury, but had a tough season-ending injury, tore a tendon in his left ankle during spring training, so missed the entire 2010 campaign. Which I think people, if you look back, it really was a kind of a seminal turning point for him because he was a kid at LSU who split time between football and baseball and really missed that. It wasn't like he missed 2 weeks or a month. He missed an entire year. Mm-hmm. And that kind of set him back, and he just hasn't been able to find a consistent offensive stroke until this last year where he got sent down to Birmingham, and instead of kind of pouting where he was returning to Birmingham again, played great there, found the consistency in Charlotte. So people thought, you know, especially with him being a left-handed hitter and some, you know, a great athletic ability, he was going to get the chance. But they ended up going with Michael Taylor, partially because they have contractual control. I mean, Rick was very honest about this. They have contractual control over Mitchell. They were very happy with what Mitchell did. But they don't have that over Taylor, you know, that
right.
He could become a minor league free agent. So they wanted to see what they had, and it makes sense. You know, they have a month to really give him a chance to play. That's not saying he's going to play every single day, but he's going to certainly get a look. You know, he knows the White Sox hitting coach, Todd Steverson, from their days in Oakland together. And, you know, I'll tell you what, we were all amazed when we saw him yesterday. The kid's he's a big kid, that's for sure. He's got some he's got some mass to him there, and he's got a good batting eye up there, they talked about, and they want to see if they can get him back. You know, that seems to be the Sox forte, is these former top prospects who have, I don't want to say gone astray, because he hasn't done anything except just hasn't performed great at the big league level, but, you know, former prospects who were highly touted, you know, a guy like Gavin Floyd, who comes to mind, who they bring back in and kind of resurrect, and I think that's what they're trying to see if they can do with Michael Taylor, and just, if nothing else, see where he fits, or does he fit, in the picture for 2015.
And that's what these last few weeks are all about for this team, is seeing who fits, who doesn't, and that's obviously part of the reason you know, they make the trades of Adam Gaughn and Alejandro De Azua and Gordon Beckham, you know, that those moves freed up some cash, brought in a few arms into the system, but also freed up opportunity at the big league level. And you know, one guy who's going to get that opportunity now is Andy Wilkins. Had a huge season at Charlotte, potential International League MVP, with 30 home runs, 38 doubles, and 85 RBIs. What's the outlook for this guy, Mark, here down the stretch?
Well, it's interesting. He got his major league debut on Sunday. I was talking to him, the final Sunday against. Now I'm blanking on who they were playing. This is against the Tigers. There we go. He got his debut, and in his last at bat, he fouled the ball off his right foot, and he really thought when it first connected that he might have broke something, and he thought, well, this is great. I've waited for this opportunity, and now I'm done after one game. But luckily, it was just bruised, and he's fine. He had an ice pack on, and he actually played in the next game as a defensive replacement late in the game. But I think you know, he is a big favorite of the player development people just because of the way he went about his business, just the consistent approach. And, you know, he's never been one of those top 20 prospect guys for the team,
right,
even, let alone top 100 in baseball type of thing. And he's just kind of, I don't want to say he's beat the odds, but just kind of worked his own way up there. And he's a good power hitter, and he had a good spring training, and he's another one who kind of found a consistent approach at the plate, just something they could stick with right along, that he said has made a difference this year. So he's definitely going to get a look. He will get, you know, the Adam Dunn at bats and that kind of lefty-righty platoon with Konerko, and that was Konerko and Dunn. Now it'll be Konerko and Wilkins through the month of September. And you made a good point, Anthony, in that the calendar may say September 2014 right now. Well, it does say that. It may not say that, but it does say that. But it really is the 2015 season for the White Sox already. I mean, you know, they're not going to be in the playoffs. They're not going to make up 13 games in the standings in 24 games. So this is really the 2015 season already. And you got to give Rick Hahn a ton of credit because, you know, Adam Dunn, Alejandro De Azua, and Gordon Beckham, and Gordon was for a player to be named later, but none of those three, marginally maybe Gordon Beckham, but none of those three were in the plans for 2015. So to get them, to move them now, and also he gave all three a chance to play in the playoffs. They're probably all three going to be in there. And they get whatever prospects, and they really like the guy they got back for Dunn. But to give other guys, not only just to move them and save a couple $1 million this year, but to give other young guys chances to play now, it really speeds up the process. He did it last year and had a great offseason, and we'll see what Rick can add on after this season. Where they, you know, they're going to win more than they did last year, and they're making strides. So, but they want to contend next year. It's not, they don't want to make it kind of an incremental thing. They think they can jump up and be in that AL Central race.
Well, I know I am, and I'm sure you are happy to see Adam Dunn get his first shot at the playoffs.
Sure. Yep.
First legit shot. But what's sort of your final analysis there of the Dunn in on the South Side area four-year, $56 million contract? Obviously, did not pan out on the field, but I know he also had an impact off the field.
Yeah, it is a weird thing, and you know from covering him, Anthony, great guy, and certainly doesn't hide from struggles, and did not handle 2011, which was, you know, arguably as bad a year as you're going to have as a player, with, you know, the class and dignity that I couldn't imagine anyone handling in terms of a workplace struggle like that, anything better than he did. And, you know, his last couple years, 2012 and 2013, his average was still down. His on-base percentage is still a little bit down below his average, but was better than, you know, it was pretty much what they thought, closer to what they thought it was going to be. But he admits, and, you know, he can't hide from it, it was not a good run for him in Chicago. That's on the field. Off the field, in terms of clubhouse influence, in terms of just the person that he was, fitting in, you know, just being part of the team, you know, A+. Great guy. You know, I remember when Scott Carroll got his first start and first victory, came up here to the White Sox, he asked Adam Dunn for a place to go to dinner. Adam gave him a place, and then in the process of giving the place, also took care of the whole bill for his entire family. And that's just the kind of thing that he did, and that's just one example. But just a good guy overall, and it was, you know, I was hoping that he would get a chance. I know you're not supposed to kind of, in our profession, objectivity is key, but I was hoping that with, you know, this is his 14th year, and close, almost 2,000 games. It was 1976 when he got traded. The active leader without playing in the playoffs. I was hoping he'd get a shot. And then, of course, what does he do? He goes to Oakland, hits a home run in the first at bat. So, yep. You know, it'll be interesting to see, because he was pretty set, it seemed like. And when he talked to me one-on-one and then the group before he left that this was his last year, it'll be interesting to see if he has a good run in Oakland, if they go deep in the playoffs and he makes a contribution, if he feels like, you know what, maybe I can go one more year. And I'll tell you what, it's not because – he's going for 500. It's because he has a chance to win. 500 homers, I'm talking about. It's because he has a chance to win and a chance to enjoy baseball again.
I'm sure he's certainly got a lot of people in the White Sox organization, you know, rooting for him down the stretch. As they themselves, as you said, Merck, really have the focus on 2015 and the future is now in Chicago in a lot of ways. So I want to thank Scott Merkin for joining us.
I'm going to be joined by Rhett Bollinger,
a Twins beat writer for MLB.com, and talk about a Twins team that has actually had a difficult season with in the prospect realm as far as just keeping those guys on the field. We've seen that again here this past week with Alex Meyer was shut down with shoulder soreness, and Nick Gordon, the number one draft pick from this year, had a left index finger broken, so he'll miss the rest of the playoffs down there. And, you know, Rhett, that's just it's kind of been par for the course, hasn't it, when you think about Buxton and Sano and what happened to them early in the season and the time they've missed, and now these two guys as well. It's been a tough year for them developmentally.
Yeah, absolutely. This is supposed to be kind of a year. It's kind of a bridge year, you know, to competitive baseball next year, and I thought that a lot of these guys, from especially Buxton and Sano, would be up here in the majors at some point, kind of getting their feet wet, you know, for next season. And so far, it's just been a lot of bad luck. You know, Buxton's been out most of the year with the wrist injuries and the concussion. The good news is he'll at least be able to play in the Arizona Fall League. But Sano's been out all year with the Tommy John, and most recently, you know, the injuries weren't quite as serious, but to have Alex Meyer, you know, one of their top pitching prospects, get shut down with a shoulder fatigue and soreness is not a good thing. But at the same time, at least it's not, you know, anything structurally wrong. He'll be able to just kind of, you know, rehab and rest a little bit here now that it's the offseason anyway, the AAA season ended. And Nick Gordon, you know, number 5 overall pick, big-time shortstop prospect, had a really good, you know, first year there at rookie-level Elizabethton. And then, sure enough, he breaks his finger just getting jammed on a ball. And now he'll miss, you know, looks like the instructional league, which would have been, you know, really big for him, because the one thing about him was, it was impressive, was once he was drafted, he went straight to Elizabethton and did a great job. But they really haven't had a chance to kind of work with him yet at the, you know, the Fort Myers complex they have with all the coaches and all that, and they're, you know, looking forward to being able to do that with him later this month. And sure enough, now that he broke his finger, he's still going to go and maybe learn from the coaches and be around it a little bit. But definitely another setback for another top Twins prospect. I think it's definitely been, yeah, par for the course this year.
Yeah, I had a chance to get to know Gordon a little bit at the draft this year. He's a really impressive kid, and obviously, you know, great pedigree with his father Tom and his brother Dee. So very I'm sure very coachable and adaptable and all that. And it's a broken finger. It's not like something that's going to impact him long-term. But I'm sure even just reporting to Instructional League and being around the coaches could be an asset for him down the line, no?
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. That kid has definitely got a good head on his shoulders. We talked to him a few times after the draft. You know, obviously, D, being his brother, knows what it's like to be around the major league clubhouses. Obviously, his dad, you know, Tom, was a big leaguer for a long time. Yeah, he definitely is very coachable. Everything I've heard from the front office, great kid. And, you know, and truthfully, yeah, to jump in as an 18-year-old straight from high school into, you know, rookie-level ball is usually pretty rare. The Twins are usually, you know, one of those teams a little bit more conservative. Don't kind of rush their guys. Usually they'll kind of have them train for a little bit maybe play in it later in the year. And for him to jump right into it was impressive. And you're right. I mean, it's just a finger, broken finger. It seems like he'll have a, finger in a splint for 2 weeks, and then he'll be fine after that. So, I mean, it's really not too much of a big setback for next year. The Twins obviously would have liked for him to be able to fully participate in instructional league, but at least he'll be able to kind of be around it and learn some stuff from all the coaches there.
Yeah. And Myers had the shoulder issues before, so that's certainly a concern. There was some thought or talk of him potentially being a September call-up. Obviously not the case now, but they did call up eight other guys at the beginning of September, and one of them was Aaron Hicks, who obviously had his struggles this season at the plate and even gave up switch hitting for a time. But, Rhett, you had a story about he got some good advice from a good guy to get advice from when it comes to hitting, didn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. He's kind of a Hall of Famer. Like Rod Carew can call you up and talk to you about hitting. You're definitely going to listen. And that's the great thing about, the Twins of the organization is they have so many former players, from Tony Oliva to Rod Carew, Ken Urbick, all sorts of, former players that have been around the game, are there for these players, And especially, Carew, he's always there in spring training helping these guys out. And he's developed a really close relationship with Aaron Hicks. And Hicks went down to Double-A, and, he was truthfully a little bit lost. He'd just given up switch hitting in the major leagues, got out to another, kind of struggle to a season just like last year, and went down to Double-A and talked to Carew. And Carew said, it's a blessing to be able to switch hit. It's just that, if you can do it, stick with it, because it's just easier for you and for a lot of reasons. Obviously, guys can't throw breaking balls that, break away from you, that kind of thing. So it just seemed like the right move for him to be able to kind of go back to it. And sure enough, he had a really good go of it at Double-A, got promoted to Triple-A, was fine there too. And now he's up here in September, which is a positive step, because last year he was optioned to Triple-A and never even came back as a September call-up. And so I think the Twins are going to try to give him some playing time here, see what he can do in the majors now that he's got a little bit more confidence, that kind of thing, down from the minors. And yesterday he made an appearance in right field late in the game, and I think they're going to try to play him in left and right field in the corners to kind of get a feel for it, especially because obviously Byron Buxton being the top prospect still seems like he's obviously going to be the center fielder of the future. So it seems like Hicks' future could also be in a corner. They figure they might want to kind of get him, get his feet wet out there in the corner outfield and see what he can do offensively too this month. I mean, it's going to be a big month for him to show, what he can do, because if he struggles again, Twins might look to the free agency route and maybe go for a corner outfielder in free agency. But if they think that maybe he can take over and be a corner outfield guy next year, maybe they don't need to do that. But, it's only 1 month to show that. But at the same time, it's going to be, kind of a big month for Hicks to show off that he can actually, hit again.
Yeah, and so much of that comes down to confidence, and hopefully he has the confidence to hit from both sides. As Carew told him, it is such a blessing and can be such an asset for a team. I'm sure there's also that we're so much more advanced statistically now, and so much more attention paid to things like platoon splits and all that. I'm sure there's temptation sometimes for switch hitters or curiosity to wonder, when is that delicate balance between sticking with it for the sake of what it can do for you and your career and the team, but also if you're struggling from one side, potentially giving up and just focusing on the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the thing with Hicks, was he gave it up because he wanted to help the team. And he was really struggling from the left side. He's a natural right-handed hitter, natural right-handed thrower. And so he gave it up thinking, okay, I think I can help the team. And did okay with it, but then hurt his shoulder and went down to Double-A and kind of stuck with it. And sure enough, even at Double-A, he realized these guys were throwing breaking balls that truthfully he'd never seen in his life. He'd never hit right-handed with a ball breaking away from him. And all of a sudden, he starts swinging and missing and realizing, okay, maybe I'm not so ready for this. And it's hard to do that in the middle of a career. I think he just kind of realized that was going to be tough for him. And after the advice of Carew, and I'm sure talking with some of the people in the Twins organization, he just realized that for his career and for the team, I mean, if he can figure it out, it's better off if he can be a switch hitter. I think he did the right thing by going back to it. But obviously, at the time, it looked kind of crazy with him going from switch hitting to switch hitting within a month's time. But it seems like, obviously, it worked out for him in the minors and kind of figured it out. And, the Twins are definitely very hopeful that he can figure out up here. Because the thing about it, I mean, he obviously was a top prospect for a reason. He's still only 25, so it's not like he's some failed prospect who's in his late 20s, still trying to figure it out. He's still only 25, so there's still time for him to kind of figure it out up here.
Brett, I love the story about A.J. Hector, who he's drafted in the 46th round in 2010, and as he points out, that round doesn't even exist anymore.
that they kind of lopped those off in recent years. But has a 2.38 ERA down in AAA, 69 strikeouts against 24 walks and 72 innings, and they decided to give him a look in the bullpen. What's the story with Actor, and you know, do you think he'll get a reasonable amount of opportunity here down the stretch?
Yeah, I think he'll definitely get some opportunities down the stretch. Gardy talked about it yesterday. Same thing. It's a really cool story. 46 rounder. Obviously, the draft now for the last couple of years is only 40 rounds. So, like Actor joke, you know, he was drafted in a round that doesn't exist anymore. That's impressive. You know, not many guys, when you get drafted that late, make it to the big leagues ever, you know. And coming from Michigan State, which isn't exactly a baseball powerhouse, is impressive, too. I want to say he's the first player from Michigan State to make the majors since Mark Mulder. So it's been a little while. And, yeah, it's a cool story. And he pitched in the Big Ten, so he said that he pitched at the Metrodome against the Gophers, but never actually, obviously, Target Field. So he's excited to get Target Field for the first time yesterday and had a, you know, pretty amazing experience for him, he's saying. His family is very excited for him, and the Twins are definitely trying to figure out a time to get him, you know, his debut, and definitely a cool story, but deserving, you know. It's not like the Twins are just going to promote him and put him on the 40-man roster just, you know, as a cool story. He had a great year in AAA, and truthfully has done well throughout his minor league career, so it's well-deserved, and, yeah, it's definitely kind of a cool thing to do and to meet the guy.
Brett, one other guy, you know, fighting for a job for next year, and you and I talked, and we both loved this trade at the deadline for the Twins just because it was kind of – it was such a low-risk acquisition, Tommy Malone for Sam Fold. Malone's definitely struggled, 18 earned runs and 20 and two-third innings pitched over five starts. What are they seeing from him? What's it going to take for him to kind of right the ship and get back in their good graces as they look ahead to 2015?
Yeah, the one thing that Tommy really has struggled, and I think one of the big things is just he's been falling behind hitters a lot and walking a lot of guys. Usually, you know, as a lefty, he's kind of more of a command, finesse-type guy who could, you know, get ahead of guys, you know, kind of make them hit his pitches and not really walk anybody. And since he's joined the Twins, his walk rate's been, you know, way higher than his career high. He's been walking a lot of guys, and it definitely has not worked out well for him so far. He had the one start that, you know, some of the numbers are skewed a little bit because he had one start where he pitched in a crazy downpour and really struggled in that one. But at the same time, he's had a couple other clunkers, too, where the weather was just fine. So okay. It's definitely been a struggle for him, but I think the Twins are still, you know, pretty confident he'll turn it around based on his track record. But so far, it's not really made a great impression. But I'm sure the Twins will stick with him through September, see what they have in him. But if he continues to struggle, he's definitely going to put himself in a tough spot in terms of as a rotation candidate for next year. But there's still a little bit of time here, you know, a couple more starts, 4 to 5 starts left to kind of salvage his season with the Twins. But so far, yeah, kind of uncharacteristically and kind of a surprise that he's kind of struggled so far.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously the Twins aren't where they want to be in the standings, but still a very important evaluation period here down the stretch. And, you know, for a more veteran guy like Malone and some of the young guys they called up for the minors. So see how that plays out. I want to thank Rhett for joining us. All right, that's a wrap. I want to thank you for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition.